Ladies and gentlemen around the Delaware Valley, welcome to the Salts Mongoloosi Bendeski Hour here on WWDB Talk 860. We've got a fantastic broadcast. Lots going on in the Delaware Valley. We have Denise George's partner at Salts Mongoloosi Bendeski on the broadcast. Denise, how are you?
I'm wonderful. How are you doing, Joe?
I couldn't be better. Allison Russell, associate here at Salts Mongoloosi Bendeski. How are you?
I'm doing well, Joe. How are you?
Fantastic. Welcome to the broadcast.
Thanks for having us.
It's my pleasure. So let's you know, it's a festive time of year, exciting time of the year. And we just last week was Thanksgiving. We're in the holiday season. Festive time of the year, for you guys.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, we're wrapping up the end of the year cases, moving everything into next year, the ones that we can. It's great, and it's a lot of holiday parties.
Fantastic.
Yes,
Denise, what does this time of year mean to you?
So this time should mean going to holiday parties, networking, closing out the year strong. However, I still have one case set for trial, set to begin at the end of next week. So I am in trial mode.
Wow. How about that? Any chance that it's going to settle beforehand?
You never know what's going to happen on the courthouse steps, but I'm hopeful.
Fantastic. Well, good luck with that. Certainly, it's a festive time of year. Love it. If you would, Denise, remind our listeners a little bit about yourself and what you do here at the firm.
So I am a partner here at the firm. I've been with Salts Mongoloosi for a little bit less than 2 years. I started my legal practice in the sunny city of Miami, Florida, where I practiced law for about 15 years, 8 of those years being a prosecutor in the county of Miami-Dade, and also almost 8 years at a civil firm in Coral Gables, Florida. So now I am a member of the medical malpractice team here at Salts, and I specialize in investigating and prosecuting cases where those that have been victims of medical malpractice, that we set forth a case, either for wrongful death or catastrophic injuries.
So what brought you east? Where are you originally from?
I born and raised in the Lehigh Valley. My entire family is in the Lehigh Valley. I just happened to graduate from law school 17 years ago this month, which was our last economic recession. And so I so badly wanted to be a prosecutor in the big city. And Philadelphia DA's office went on between like a hiring freeze, cutting jobs, and I didn't get an opportunity up here. And I got one in Miami, and I so badly wanted to go to the big city. So I decided to take an additional bar examination and move south. And I thought I would be down there and fulfill my 3-year commitment. And 3 turned into 15.
How about that? And I want, how did that impact you in regards to, you know, how you practice now, that, you know, being a prosecutor in Miami and in a busy county? How did that impact what you do today?
It prepared me for handling the type of cases that I have every day. I deal in human tragedy. I've been dealing in human tragedy for 17 years. But as a prosecutor, you have the burden of proof. That burden is much higher than what we do as civil attorneys. But as a civil attorney, you again have the burden. And every single day, you need to advance your cause. You need to advance your case.
And so, having said that, let me segue to Allison Russell, if you will, a little bit about yourself and what you do here at the firm and your pathway.
Sure, Joe. So I've been at the firm for just under 3 years.
By the way, you
now.
Got that late night. She's got that late night talk voice flat out. I'm sorry, go ahead.
I'm going to listen to this later and really be very embarrassed about the way my voice sounds.
I don't think so.
I started at the firm just under 3 years ago. I'm in the mass tort and toxic tort department here. My pathway to get here is a little bit different than Denise's. I have not moved out of the city of Philadelphia. I went to school at Villanova Law School. I was an intern at an insurance defense firm in between college and law school, just to kind of make sure this is what I wanted to do. You know, it's a very abstract concept going to law school until you actually get there and get some, you know, hands on the paper. Decided I wanted to go to law school, kept working at this insurance defense firm throughout law school. But I worked at this firm in a tiny little plaintiffs group there. And it was three of us. There were three attorneys in this big defense firm. Basically, we realized as a firm we could get referrals within the firm. And we had a little plaintiffs group going, and it was great.
It was interesting because I was reading a little bit about your bio and your background, and it said, you know, defense and plaintiffs. I was wondering what that – does that happen a lot? I mean, that's a very interesting very interesting situation to have a plaintiffs group, within a defense firm.
Yeah, no, I don't think it's common, mainly because there are a lot of conflicts when that happens. So if you go and you sue someone who has a particular insurance company and your firm represents that insurance company, of course, that's not going to work out. So we were limited, but I learned that I really liked the plaintiff's work. I was hired there after I graduated from law school to do partly plaintiff's work, but I also moved into a little bit of insurance defense work, mainly on the medical malpractice side.
So it's interesting because, Denise, you talked about being a prosecutor, okay, and that was your pathway. We've been doing this a long time, and when I think about a lot of the things, civil sexual assault would be a very sensitive area, right? And criminal law, civil cases related to criminal acts. Yep. Okay, I have often wondered, especially when it's a criminal case. Okay, say it, and so think about this for a second. There's an assault or some kind of crime that happens in a dimly lit parking lot, okay? And it's not the first time it's happened. Five, six, seven, eight times, okay? To me, okay, and justice, it happens in the courtroom. But as a prosecutor, you're obviously going after the bad guys and creating justice that way. I often wondered, though, if I came up with this term. In fact, I was talking to one of the attorneys here who actually said in, I believe it was certain counties, you can do it. But I wonder sometimes why the DA's office does not refer. So when you're providing justice to somebody who's been assaulted, okay, why not also recommend to them a civil attorney, because they may be badly injured and never be able to work again? And that, to me, the owner of that parking lot is as much of an accomplice as anybody. I call that maximum justice.
That term.
It's interesting. I mean, because that person, may be badly injured. Okay, and it's, of course, we want to get the criminal off the street and all that, but we often can't sue a criminal who commits that, because there's nothing there. I mean, either way, that's not the point. You're prosecuting them.
It's a different burden.
It is.
You're talking especially when it comes to aggravated battery or a sexual assault case, there must be an intent to harm.
Right, but what I'm saying is, have the DA's office also refer to a civil firm, the individual who was the injured, so that they can also get justice from a civil point, because that might be something that not only creates justice, by putting that individual behind bars, but also making that individual, you're never going to make them whole, but you may be able to help them now that, for example, they've been assaulted badly. Is that?
It happens. So I will give you a perfect example, which is the reason why I transitioned from being a prosecutor to a civil attorney. I, as a prosecutor in Miami-Dade, there was a separate specialized unit for traffic homicides. And the cases that were prosecuted by this unit were primarily DUI manslaughter cases or high profile leaving the scene of an accident with death case. And I was a member of this unit. I volunteered to be a member of this unit, which just meant additional responsibility of being on call, investigating cases, taking on additional cases. And I had a case where there was an unfortunate circumstance where a gentleman who left behind two daughters and a wife was killed by a drunk driver on Key Biscayne, and there was an ongoing issue due to the lack of bike lanes where those at night, because it's such a narrow lane, were veering off the roadway, and they killed this individual who was riding his bicycle early in the morning, and there was a large cycling community that did the same. And this individual was 21 years old. He was home on Christmas break. He was partying on South Beach. He had way too much to drink. He was returning to his home where he veered from the roadway into the bike lane. He struck two individuals, killing one, severely injuring another. And then he left the scene and he went home, and then he panicked and he called the cops. And then he said that someone stole his car and bashed out his window. And eventually he came back to the scene of the accident. And he was clearly impaired. His blood showed that, just his normal faculties were also impaired. And it was a call that I received early that morning from a traffic homicide detective. And it was my job to investigate that case. And I brought charges. And eventually, after months of investigation, he pled guilty. He took a sentence to prison, followed by house arrest, followed by 10 years of probation. And my victims, being the surviving spouse and the daughters, they retained my former law firm, Coulson Hicks Idson. And that firm then brought a civil suit against this individual and his father, who owned the vehicle. So while I was investigating, I was also sharing information with the civil firm as to what club he was at, the video evidence that I had, and I was able to gather a lot of information because as a prosecutor, you can send out warrants and you can send out subpoenas, and it's much easier when there's a criminal investigation. But I did share all of my information. And so there was a resolution, it was a confidential resolution between the parties down the line. And I will tell you, there was a meeting that occurred in Coral Gables. I was present. The civil attorneys were present. The surviving spouse and the minor children were present, along with the defendant who killed this individual and his lawyers. And this was an opportunity for him to say that he was sorry. It was a very emotional meeting. It was an opportunity for the next of kin to ask questions that they had. And so there was justice done in the courtroom, and then there was justice done in this meeting. And so after this individual went to prison, I got an email a few months later asking whether or not I was ready to move on with my career. And that's how I got a job offer. That's why I left my job, which I will tell you is probably one of the most rewarding and redeeming professions that I've ever been.
Well, I was going to say, the pathway to Salts Mongoose at Bendesky. Okay. Allison, I'll ask you first. What brought you here?
Well, first of all, Salts has a fantastic reputation. I've been here, like I said, just under 3 years. And at a certain point in my career, I'm in my 10th year. I was at my former firm for 6.5 years. And at a certain point in time, I realized I really just want to represent plaintiffs. And I could only do so much of that at an insurance defense firm. You can only do so much, like we've discussed. One of the first cases I was involved with at my old firm was a dram shop case. So it was also a drunk driving case. But the victim was the person who was drunk driving, and we represented his family. It was a case that I will never forget. It was one of the first that I had my hands on, first as an intern, and then when I graduated, was able to take on the case as a lawyer. And I'll never forget looking at the photographs. I can still see them in my head of what this kid went through, and he was a kid, and just pursuing justice on behalf of the family. That really has stuck with me for almost 10 years now. And when I decided to make the move to a full-blown plaintiff's firm, that family was in my head. And all of the other people I had worked with, working with people is so much more gratifying to me than working for an insurance company. And that's not to undermine that.
Because there's a purpose for it, right?
Absolutely. There is a purpose for all of this that we do. My type of personality is I like to work with people and humans and individuals. And I found that I can do my best for other people when I'm on the plaintiff's side. Salts Mongoluzzi Bendeschi was the number one spot I wanted to be at. And I knew that for a long time before I decided to make the switch. So this was an obvious choice, and I was given an opportunity to come here. And I feel grateful. It's a fantastic place.
Well, I've sat in these offices over the last several years doing this broadcast and often wondered, because we have a lot, there's a wide array of different firms and, you know, different situations. I can imagine what it's like for a defense firm to come up here. You know, normally it's David versus Goliath, and when you come up here, you got to be going, okay, they're not going to just roll. I mean, to say they're not going to roll over if you took the case, and I know how, you know, what it's like, you know, with the vast amount of experience and resources, it has to be an interesting, like, you know, from a defense firm's perspective, they got to know that if they're coming up here and sitting at these tables, that, you know,
we mean business.
You mean business.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, and so it's just sitting right here and doing this show. I love doing this monthly show. I'm glad we're not in the
salts room.
The room with where you have the screen. It's there's
the
no
AV
view.
AV room.
The AV room.
There's no view in there.
There's no view. But having said that, what brought you here, Denise, to Salts Mongoluzzi Bendeschi?
So, born and raised in Pennsylvania. Again, I never thought I would relocate to Florida, and I did in 2008. But the pandemic was a significant change in my life, and it was an opportunity to really sit down when the travel stopped and things calmed at the office, and I really had to do some deep reflection as to what I wanted the next 25 years of my legal career to be and where. And I just did not imagine a scenario that didn't include my family. And so I had to leave my comfort where I knew the bench, I knew the bar, I knew all the players, I was very comfortable with Florida law. And there was a decision 2 years ago this month that I needed to make. And that was to move back up here. And similar with Allison's sentiments, when I started doing my research and started talking to the players in Philadelphia, everyone steered me to Salts Mongoluzzi Bendeschi. And they told me that I would be happy here and that the members of this firm would set me up for success. And they have.
And the resources here, okay, one thing, it's amazing when you sit down and As somebody who is catastrophically injured, okay, you have to make the proper decision on where you're going to, who's going to represent you if it's at the result of somebody else, okay. Talk about the resources and the experience around the table, okay, and what that means to a client, okay, who may not even know it. You know, somebody's sitting right now at a table, and they're in front of somebody who is a friend of a friend of a friend, and we all have friends that have cousins that are lawyers, and maybe that lawyer is an outstanding landlord-tenant attorney, or maybe, you know, they're outstanding at wills and estates, and some. But you know what? I went to school with Bob, and Bob's cousin's in need. I'm going to jump in here and handle that case, right? Doing somebody a favor. But they don't know that that person, as good as they are at the one area of law, may not have the resources. And they may never have been in the situation. Talk about what it means to be sitting in that room right there with that group of, you know, your colleagues around the table, knowing that, A, the experience is in the room, you know, is second to none, and you can compete with the insurance company who has endless coffers. Denise?
So starting with the members of this firm, when we're sitting across the table from a client, the client isn't just retaining us as their lawyers. They are retaining Salts Mongoluzzi Bendeschi in the decades upon decades of experience. That means that Bob Mongoluzzi will walk into a courtroom and try a case with us. The same goes for Larry Bendeschi or Steve Wigreiser or Drew Duffy or Adam Pantano. These are real lawyers that will not back down to anyone. So when clients retain us, they are also retaining the reputation and the experience of this firm that gets results.
And just to add on to that, I completely agree with what Denise said. When you hire one of us as your attorney for a case,
you have all of you.
You have all of us. And it's not just the reputation. It's not just the name. We go into each other's offices day in and day out to strategize on cases that I may go in to talk to Denise about a legal issue or a particular factual issue on a case that I just have a question about. I want to kind of bounce some ideas off of her, see what she thinks, get a set of fresh eyes on that. That happens every single day at this firm. During our entire firm meetings, our attorney meetings, we present cases to get an entire room full of attorneys' opinions on that case, what the value is. You're getting the knowledge from everyone here, and that you don't get everywhere.
When we talk about resources, okay, and we talk about, because there's experts that you need, and that is a big deal. When we talk about resources, we're talking about having, the money to be able to get the best experts, because you're up against it, and you're making it, and you can only make a decision based on what you're capable of doing. Talk about that and not having to ever make a decision based on, do we have the resources to be able to get this expert who might be the number one person in the country because the insurance company has the number three guy. So what does that mean to a client?
I mean, a lot of times we explain that to the client because the client doesn't fully grasp what experts have to do with a case. Most clients don't understand that. They're lay people. They've been injured. And so they're coming to us for all of this. For us, we explain to them that, our network is huge. We have contacts with experts. We have contacts with other attorneys who can refer us experts. Maybe there's, a number one expert for a particular case, and the same type of expert is not the number one expert for a different type of case. So we have really a large contingent of people that we can reach out to at any point in time. So that goes a long way. The money aspect, which I think is what you're implying earlier, is huge. Absolutely. We have done really well for our clients and have been able to build up to the point where we certainly can hire really good experts for cases. It also goes to analyzing a case before you really move forward with it. And I think that that's a really important aspect to talk about, is when you have a client come to you and you say, I want you to look at my case. I want Salts Mongoluzzi Bendeschi to look at my case. We take that seriously. We don't mess around. We don't lie. We don't tell our clients, you've got a case if we don't think there's a case. And we're going to be very honest with them because we don't want to pursue something on behalf of someone who at the end of the day is not going to get anything in return. That just doesn't make sense.
It's an interesting science, though, because sitting from where I'm sitting, right, you don't ever know what's going to happen at the end. You can only take the best calculated make the best calculated moves. So if you're willing to spend $50,000 on a top expert and it doesn't come out of anybody's, and above, you've got to be confident, because like you just said, you don't want a client having to go through, a lengthy situation and then at the end having, all the resources. They don't have a client with the contingency fee does not have to pay out of pocket, which is, to me, still freaks me out, right? I mean, like, literally, you could work for years without getting paid. But that's
how confident we are.
That's right. However, you also have to be an expert on saying, okay, and that's what gets me. Like, you're spending hundreds of thousands of dollars because you know you need it, because you know the value by that time is there for your client. But you really got to know that, right? Because the last thing, and I think you were kind of alluding to that, is you don't want your client to go through 3 years of stuff and the settlement go all to the experts. So it's to me, a lot of experts involved. What can a client expect when they retain you, Denise, and your qualities. I sat here, we've done a show before, and this is the second one. I'm already 100% sure that, I want you on my side.
So clients know that I'm willing to run through a concrete wall for them. Clients understand that when I get a case, that I am going to look at every single piece of paper, that I am going to turn over every single rock, and that I am going to be diligent, I am going to be organized, and I am going to be prepared. And if I need to fight, I'm going to fight for them. Like, we all take this job personal.
Did you play sports growing up?
I did not.
Where'd you get that competitive?
It is being the youngest and having two older brothers who, just decided to, terrorize me as a child. So I had no choice but to fight back. But also, as a woman in this profession, we must work harder than our male counterparts. I had the pleasure of sitting down with a senior judge yesterday who was one of the first to graduate of her class in the 70s practicing law. And so I want clients, when I sit down with them, to understand that I care about them and I care about their cause. And so therefore that takes hard work. And there are no bounds. That means evenings. It means weekends. It means whatever they need. So there is some accountability and there is peace and there is justice. It is my job to give them answers. I can't promise them a great result. I can only promise them answers. And I take that very seriously.
Allison? Yeah, what can they expect when you're representing that client, when you're the point person?
First of all, one of my favorite parts about representing plaintiffs is the client contact. Like I mentioned earlier, I really like corresponding with clients. I like working for them. So I like them to know that they can contact me at any point in time, ask any question they want to ask. We may not know at that very moment. Like Denise said, we can't promise them what they're going to end up with, if anything. But what we can do is hear them, listen to them, and give them answers. Look into every little detail.
What's interesting is, and you're both alluding to it, is that one thing you can promise them is the best representation possible.
Yes.
Okay, and the best opportunity to succeed. Well, I think about a settlement, right, or a verdict, okay? Somebody's catastrophically injured. What does that mean? What does that verdict represent? The rest of their life, living in dignity, okay? And we'll get to a couple other things when it comes to that. But we're in the Philadelphia region. Are you from?
I live currently in Philadelphia.
But where did you grow up, in the Delaware Valley region?
Yes, in Eagleville, Norristown area.
Oh yeah, okay. Yeah. There you go. Mm-hmm. So we tend to have some grit around here,
and certainly
you mentioned women in the law. Okay, let's talk about that before we get into mass torts, okay, and medical malpractice, okay. You mentioned obviously having to work harder, and certainly prove yourself, and talk about that, how that's been like from when you started to where you're at now. You're at a massive firm. I mean, as good as it gets. But talk about that pathway, Allison, if you would.
Sure. I think for me, it dates back to high school, maybe even before. But I've always been a very competitive person. I played lacrosse growing up. I did sports outside of that, but lacrosse was my main sport. I played in college. I grew up with four brothers. I've always had this feeling that I've got to fight for what I need, what I want. And so competition has kind of just always been in me. I remember I was in a class in my senior year of high school, and I had a teacher start asking us, oh, what do you want to do, after college or for college or whatever? I said, I want to go to law school. And he laughed at me and said, oh, good luck with that. And it put this massive, massive chip on my shoulder, and I will never forget that.
And you probably can't thank him enough, because now, A, proved them wrong. And by the way, here I am.
And by the way,
you know who was like, I mean, Tom Brady. Like, he used to invent. Now, I mean, my wife loves Tom Brady, right? In fact, we had Tom Brady's his diet book, right? But when we beat them in the Super Bowl, that was out the door that weekend, right? But a lot of individuals who are successful. I love that commercial. I love it. The one where it says, got all the college kids playing sports, and 99.5% of these kids are going to go pro in something other than, those lessons stay with you, for your entire life, and being competitive at an early age and having those older brothers and getting those situations. Those are the things that, those are the life's lessons that are, and I imagine all those things, that education, everything. But you still have to have the personality to be able to maintain, when that person comes in here. I can sit here and, every person out that door. Now, I've, as a union iron worker for a lot of years, I was fortunate that I wasn't on a lot of jobs with a lot of catastrophic injuries. But I will tell you something, and I'm not sure if you know this. One of the first big cases, if not the first big case, that Bob and Larry Duffy represented was the Tropicana case in Atlantic City. That guy was my boss, Mike Whitland, one of the nicest guys on the planet. Wow. I didn't work down there. And my father, being the head of the ironworkers union for 40 years, he never went to a work comp attorney. He would call these guys here because we got cat. Unfortunately, it wasn't. But one time in my life, I was a steward on a job at 47th and Lancaster, and a good friend of mine got electrocuted. God bless him. He lost his arm. I saw that, and it was just crazy. My point is, you people see this stuff. Maybe not at the point of injury, but every day somebody comes in here, and it ain't just with a sprained ankle, okay? You may be the smartest person in the room, a lot of the rooms you walk in, but just because you are doesn't mean you're going to be able to handle that, that person and that family who just lost. How do you handle that? Because great lawyers and great firms also understand that. I walk in, you sit down, you talk to Bob or Larry, and you would think that there'd be heirs everywhere. Like, in other words, thinking that these guys are as down to earth as possible. This is Larry Bendesky. Okay, I mean, he's about as nice as you can get. Right?
Absolutely.
The whole firm is like that. That quality is integral in being a great firm and great attorneys. How do you, and what prepares you for and being able to handle that when somebody, a family walks in? We can sit here and talk all we want about, different things, but this is where the rubber meets the road. How do you handle that situation? And really, how do you recover from it after they leave and get to do it again the next day? Talk about that.
I think there's a human element. I see it as I need to show my clients empathy. The worst possible thing has happened to them, has happened to their families, that affects their quality of life, be it physical or mental or emotional. And they endure this pain and this suffering from the moment they wake up to the moment they fall asleep. And it is my job to divorce the emotion a bit, take a step back, look at things clinically so that I could make appropriate decisions in our legal world that will improve their quality of life. I don't think there's anything that trains you for this. I did 8 years as a prosecutor, many of those on homicide duty, where I unfortunately had to go out to scenes and I saw the aftermath of violence. And I will tell you that every homicide took pieces away from me that I will never be able to get back, nor will I ever be able to unsee. But in those moments, I took a step back and I'm looking over at the family who has just gotten the worst possible news. And it was my job to find out who did this, why did they do this? And so similar parallel here in the civil world of an incident occurred, either a bad accident at a workplace or there was a medical error that cost an individual their entire life. It is my job to get answers.
Having said that, as a woman, and we mentioned, do you feel underestimated at times when, you know, you walk in and maybe even in the courtroom, you know, you got five suits on the other side. How much do you enjoy that, number one? And we talk, you know, and let's see how it goes afterwards. You know what I mean?
I love that. I love when someone underestimates me because of what I look like, because of my gender, because I'm short. I love that. I have walked into a courtroom once before. I was at my old firm and went into, and this was on the defense side, went into a courtroom in New Jersey, and the opposing attorney knew the judge, and he's schmoozing with him and said something, you know, about me being a Pennsylvania lawyer and probably doesn't know anything about New Jersey. And I just remember saying to the judge when I was given my chance to speak and really, you know, holding it in until it was my turn to speak and just saying, you know, I am actually barred in New Jersey, and then kind of rattling off my argument and winning that argument. And it feels so good. It feels so good. It lights a fire when people underestimate you.
And for young women who come into the field, okay, and what advice would you give them in regards to not stepping back on that? You, obviously, you have to navigate in life, okay? You walk in your first day, somebody, I've heard story where young people have walked in and somebody says something stupid, and they're like, okay, I know where I'm at, I know what, but I'm just going to bide my time, and you know, because you can't just fire out of there. You know, I mean,
the key in my mind is discernment and knowing exactly what you're saying, knowing when to speak up, kind of surveying what's going on, proving yourself through your work first, and then being able to back it up with your words once you've proven yourself. But that's the first step, is you have to prove yourself. You can't just come in and expect everyone to look at you and say, oh, they're going to be great based on where they went to school or what they've done in the past. You have to prove yourself, no matter who you are.
So this is a conversation I got a whole 2 hours on this, you know, but I already know, you know why we're here and the success that you both created. Let's talk. We have about 20 minutes, so let's talk about mass torts, medical malpractice. Okay, we talked about where they mesh a little bit. Are there ever any cases where your paths will ever cross?
Potentially. Potentially. We have, on the mass tort side right now, it's what we like to call a mini mass tort.
Well, what is mass tort for our listeners?
So mass tort is, it's kind of quite literally litigation involving a particular tort that has a massive amount of plaintiffs. It's very different from a class action.
I was going to say, sounds like a class action.
So we have a class action department, but that is completely separate from what our mass tort team does. The class action suits involve a very particular type of class where the plaintiffs have similar injuries, the similar accident happened, usually involving a product. The mass tort side is these people have not necessarily sustained the same injury. They all have their own individual cases, but they're similar based on what happened to them.
Who's on your team?
Larry Cohan, who I know you've interviewed in the past.
I have.
Yep. And Josh Cohan and Dave Magana.
So there's an Irish film called The Four Cohans. I don't know. No, not the Irish film. That's Yankee Doodle Dandy. At Jimmy Cagney. But, you know, had the pleasure of interviewing Larry and his son.
Okay.
And very interesting area because to a layperson, you think, you know, first thing I asked my wife before I left, I said, you know what mass torts is? And she said, of course, no, but I think it's like a class action. And I said, well, it's not exactly a class action, but I was doing my homework before we came here.
Exactly.
And it's very interesting.
There's a difference, absolutely.
Oh, no doubt about it. What do you like about that? You know, the area that you on the team you're on?
So most of our mass torts involve environmental hazards. So there's, you know, for example, we're involved in the Camp Lejeune litigation right now.
Yes.
Which is water contamination.
Water contamination.
This has affected our military service men and women and their families for over three decades, from the 50s through the 80s. It's so important to me to be able to rectify that for this particular group of people. And so I love doing that on their behalf. And we get to work with other plaintiffs' firms who represent other individuals who were harmed by that contamination too. So it's very much like a group project, but with people who actually care about the work.
But what's interesting, though, is that you have... you're in a situation, you know, I can't think about it for a second. You're in the military, okay? Mm-hmm. You're there, and the water's contaminated,
yeah.
And you don't know it.
Yep, but the government does.
But the government does.
The people you're
fighting
for.
How long does it take for a mass tort to come to fruition?
You mean when you say come to fruition? Pay out?
Yes.
It can be. Years, it can be a decade, it can be longer. It really depends on which mass tort we're talking about. Now, the Camp Lejeune litigation is a little bit different than some other mass torts we've been involved in because it's statutory. It was well past the this is well beyond the statute of limitations that would allow someone to normally sue for this, and they're suing the government, which is prohibited. Congress thought that these people deserve compensation because of what happened to them. So a bill was passed and signed into law by President Biden on August 10th, 2022. That opened up a two-year window for people to bring a lawsuit based on this water contamination. So what we've been doing over the past 2 years, and now we're past the deadline to file those claims, is seeking out people who have been harmed.
Educating. Right.
Exactly. And really, to be honest, fighting the VA, because the VA, for some reason, has been telling people that they can't do this.
Yeah, okay. So, by the way, that show, and I've done that show, and it's... I had somebody one time, we're going to get into medical malpractice in 2 seconds, but I had somebody literally sit there and tell me, and it was one of the smartest things I'd ever heard. I did it where he said, you know, all this red tape with the VA, why don't we just give everybody a personal choice card and just cut the whole VA out?
Yep.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like what they've done and made it so difficult, all the red tape. So I'm not surprised at that.
Yeah.
Denise, if you will, medical malpractice. Okay, now, I had a good buddy of mine call me from the hospital and say, listen, the doctor was late. I think I'm going to sue him. I'm like, listen, I'm not a lawyer or anything like that, but I've done a couple of these shows. You probably need a little more than that. Obviously, medical malpractice, it's such a specialized area that I did a show yesterday with somebody at that location across the street from City Hall, it was a one person firm, a good guy, but it said medical malpractice. I was going to actually go into the show and say, listen, we're only talking med mal, right? To have him go, I guess, no. So many firms, they'll advertise it, but that's only because they want to refer to cases out. You guys do it for real at the highest level. You're on there with Steve Wiggs?
Yes, Wig Reiser, also known as the Silver Fox, is the team leader of the medical malpractice division, along with my colleagues Jason Weiss and Morgan Kendall. All we do all day long is pore over tens of thousands of pages of medical records, compare and contrast medical records that we received in pre-suit versus what the healthcare facilities hide from you during suit. And they think you're not going to look over it because they gave you 40,000 pages of medical records. So back to this, and this has become a feature in a case that I'm not going to get into great detail, but there was an astonishing record that we received prior to filing suit. And it was a 2-page document by a surgeon that magically disappeared from litigation after this healthcare facility produced the medical records pertaining to the care and treatment of our client. But there is a statistic right now that medical errors is now the third leading cause of death.
By the way, I'm not surprised, okay? I had to get knee surgery, and I'll never forget being in the hospital. And it was a reputable hospital, and it went well, thank God. But I remember five different people coming in and asking me the same questions. And I realized at one point, I'm like, okay, these are different vendors coming in. They don't, you know, they're not communicating with one another. I'm not saying that that's the reason why, but there's a lot of moving parts, okay? And I heard that statistic. So, but don't med mal cases have to be certified?
They have to be certified. So we need to hire experts within the same specialty to provide opinions on standard care, meaning someone deviated from the guidelines, and then we would need a specialist in a different area of medicine to provide us an opinion that the medical error caused the harm. And sometimes we call them causation experts, depending on the case, like for instance, a birth injury case. You can have about four causation experts because they have to eliminate other causes that could potentially cause cerebral palsy. And so you may have a neonatologist, you may have a pathologist, you may have a pediatric neurologist. And so these experts add up. So all day long, I pay experts thousands of dollars to Zoom with me. And we review medical records and we talk about theories of liability and theories of causation. And we also talk about what the possible defense theories could be. And after every single meeting, I always end with, can you send me some medical journals? I have a subscription to the New England Journal of Medicine that I receive. And I read the same journal articles that physicians are reading because the only way I am going to successfully prosecute
is
these
if you
cases,
know the medicine.
I have to become a fake expert. And so my family members call me all the time.
Oh, yeah.
Because well, I have experts at my disposal as well.
When you think of the different types of med mal cases, okay, misdiagnosis, what are the most common?
They're failures to diagnose. There are failures to appreciate signs and symptoms. It's the failure of doctors to rule out the worst first.
How many times have you been involved in a case where you knew that the plaintiff was not going to be there at the end?
Unfortunately, many. I have had great satisfaction in representing those that are paraplegics or quadriplegics whose entire lives have been devastated. But as a result of that devastation, they are at risk of infection every single day. And all it takes is one urinary tract infection to become sepsis and for them to enter the hospital, contract something else, and never return home. And it's very unfortunate, but it happens.
What's it like for both of you to know that you're the only thing standing in the way, you know, like in other words, from somebody not having a quality of life, like they may not, but you are responsible for their in a sense in their dignity, okay, you know, because if it doesn't go well, okay, and it's one of the great things about this firm, if you take the case, it means you're believing in it. There is no guarantee, but what's that responsibility like? You're talking to you're actually talking to a former serviceman or woman who drank the contaminated water, and you know the government knew about it. Like we need a few good men and women, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
And that's what we get. You know that responsibility is means what to you?
Oh, it means the world. It's why I do this. It's a massive responsibility that we hold every day, but it's why we do this, to take on that responsibility and take that burden off of our clients. The first thing that you do is you listen to the client, particularly this group of people that we represent, these men and women.
You get to talk to them directly.
Yes, and I make it my mission to talk to every single one and to be available to every single
one. What's
some
of the worst effects of the contamination?
Parkinson's disease, kidney cancer, liver cancer, and one of the worst, and not, I guess I shouldn't compare them, but the birth defects and the birth injuries. Childhood leukemia is actually was one of the reasons that they found out that the water was contaminated. One of the people who really started the ball rolling for this litigation to open up and happen, his name's Jerry Ensminger, and his daughter was born at Camp Lejeune, swam in the water. He was a Marine, and she passed away from childhood leukemia. And he tells this story, and it's horrifying. And, you know, he lived for a couple decades just not knowing what happened, really blaming himself. What could he have done? Didn't really understand why this happened to her. And one day he was sitting on his couch, and he's watching the TV, and a commercial came on about Camp Lejeune. It said, we're doing a study on kids who had childhood leukemia who were at Camp Lejeune. There seems to be some sort of pattern. He said he was standing there with a plate of meatballs and dropped the plate, and it shattered everywhere, and that started it for him. And so to hear him tell that story and then to hear so many others tell very similar stories.
That is absolutely unbelievable. And then the unforgivable part. What?
They knew about it.
Right. They knew about it.
Yep.
To me, he dropped it when he saw the commercial. And then when he found out they knew about it, unforgivable. Denise, what's it like when you have a situation and there's a medical malpractice situation and you see it, it's negligent and you lose a child. So a family has lost a child. They're standing them right in front of you. Or it was a misdiagnosis, and you know somebody's going to lose their life. That responsibility to you.
So it's very profound. I will tell you that in this realm, the most innocent, the most vulnerable are the babies. The babies that are born as a result of a medical error, where during labor and delivery, mom is hooked up to a fetal heart monitor and there are clear signs of fetal distress, and there is a very reluctant registered nurse or a nurse midwife who fails to bring these cries for help to the attention of a doctor. And always in these cases, you always evaluate the timeline. And the one burning question is, what were they waiting for?
Yeah, I've heard nightmare stories like that. I mean, you hear that. Does that, I mean, there's only, what does that do to you in regards to motivating, you know, motivating you? Like you need motivation. I've been sitting here for an hour with both of you, and if I'm going to war, you two are on the front lines. But what does it make? You know, you're like, give me the ball. I'm ready. You know, how's that? What's that feeling and that responsibility like?
I'm motivated because I'm trying to provide this family with some semblance of a better quality of life. I had a young girl that I represented, and again, it was a situation. There was a pattern of a non-reassuring fetal heart rate, and the C-section was called far too late, and she was born without heart rate, without a pulse, without any tone. She had to be resuscitated. She had to be cooled, and then she was diagnosed with spastic quadriplegia, cerebral palsy, global developmental delays, an irretractable epilepsy. And every single month for 8 years, fire rescue was called to her house at least once because she had a seizure, and her parents experienced this seizure and they didn't know whether their daughter was going to live or die.
Okay. So I have one final question for both of you. Getting justice is... there isn't enough money on the planet, okay, that somebody can be awarded for the things that we're talking about and the lives that are damaged, and it's up to you to and your teams to seek justice for those things. But change happens in the courtroom. You're not only seeking justice for a settlement that will help that family or that person live in dignity and with the proper, medical treatment, all that for the rest of their life. But you're also doing it so it doesn't happen to somebody else. Okay. Talk about what that means to you. We only have 2 minutes, but it's a big one. Denise, if you will.
It's It's funny, as I was walking up here, I wrote down a note, and every conversation that I have with a client in the early stages, and I ask them, why do you want to pursue this? And their answer is, I want to ensure this never happens again.
It doesn't get more real than that and more genuine.
And I can't make any promises because there is a difference. Like when I gave the example of the cyclist being mowed down because there wasn't a clearly designated bike lane. In those instances, you can then possibly file a suit against the city where you can instill policy and you can make changes. But in some of these medical error cases, it's a one-off of a doctor just was incompetent that day or made a mistake that day that had catastrophic ramifications. But I can't promise that it's never going to happen again. I know, like, Allison, in dealing with her specialty, like when it comes to a product or something that's far more overreaching, there can be a recalled product that can ensure that that instance never happens
again.
Well,
I can tell you this, though. Certainly at that hospital and the education, I've done some Med Mal shows with some defense attorneys, and they're doing everything they can to educate that, you know, their doctors at that, so they don't do it again. But that's a point we'll take. Allison, if you will, that the opportunity to ensure to the best of your ability that it doesn't happen to somebody else, what's that mean?
The same as Denise. I mean, the bulk of our clients say the same thing to us. They don't want it to happen again. They don't want anyone else to go
through it. That sentiment is beautiful.
It's huge, though. I mean, it's really important to these clients because they're in it. They're feeling it, and they never want to have someone else feel like that. So that is put on us, right? We take that seriously, and similar to what Denise said, there's not always the ability to do that. Sometimes all we can do is win the case for you and get you money. But we will try everything in our power. If there is a possibility to have a more overreaching result, we'll do that. Absolutely.
Ladies, it's been a fantastic, fastest hour ever. We're leaving about 3 hours on the table. I want to thank Denise Georges and Allison Russell of Salts, Margulies, and Medeski for being our guests on the Salts, Margulies, and Medeski show.
Thank you so much for having us, Joe.
Definitely my pleasure. On behalf of Denise and Allison and everybody here at Salts, Margulies, and Medeski, I'm Joe Dougherty. Thanks for listening, everybody.